To take a little bit of a different tack today. And what I'm going to do is basically introduce to you the book of Romans. And I'm going to try to, over the next year, I guess this year, 2015, I'm going to salt and pepper chapters of the book of Romans throughout the year to go through them line upon line, like a Bible study. And we'll be doing that on somewhat of a semi-regular occasion. I'm not going to do it every time that I go ahead and speak, but I do want to take some time for the book of Romans because it is an important book. I don't know if you realize it or not, but the book of Romans and Hebrews are probably one of the most comprehensive treatises of New Testament doctrine and lifestyle and transitional information from the Old Testament based off of that to the New Testament, giving it that new flair of connection that comes off of and is built from the platform of the Old Testament. And it is important, brethren, it is important to understand this, especially in a world that we live in that claims the Old Testament has no application. Because if the Old Testament has no application, you could say easily that the book of Romans and Hebrews is nothing but a bunch of hot air. That's how important these two books are. The Apostle Paul was a well-educated guy. And he wrote the book of Romans. Many people claim that he wrote the book of Hebrews too. Good reason to think he did because of the technicalness of it, if I can use that term. It's a very technical book, the book of Hebrews, because it is a very comprehensive transitional book that takes you from the sacrificial system into the New Testament transition of Christ being the sacrifice and the Lamb and so on. That's another story left for perhaps maybe 2016, but God willing. But for this year, 2015, we're going to basically kind of focus on the book of Romans throughout the year, salt and pepper it. Today I want to take some time essentially to introduce to you some of the background of the book of Romans, kind of jump around throughout the book to illustrate to you some of the things that this book does present and hopefully wet your whistle to see that there will be more to come as we proceed through each chapter, line upon line, as we go through it. And I might go ahead and use some of these chapters or Bible study opportunities in the book of Romans to schedule some Bible studies this year as well. And I wanted to ask you before I get started, because it seems like after services, if we hold Bible studies, they haven't really been, quite frankly, quite honestly, attended that well. And I don't know why, but I'm just thinking that in light of the past history of having Bible studies after services, that would it be preferred and more apt to be attended, if indeed these subjects would interest you, to attend these Bible studies before services? So we would start maybe the Bible study at 10 o'clock, and maybe start services at 11:30 on that particular Sabbath. Would that interest you? Can I see your hands? You guys are late sleepers on the Sabbath. My pride's gone. All right, how about after services? Would that be more preferable? Okay, that's okay. We'll keep it there then. We'll keep it there. I'm going to hold you to your word now. But we'll keep it after services. Then we'll have a little bit of food or something, and then on those days I'll make mention if indeed we go ahead and do that. But at any rate, I wanted to start here in the book of Romans, and as I mentioned, the book does serve to be a very comprehensive exposition, and this is why it's so important, a very comprehensive exposition on the details of salvation and how this process, the mechanics, the logistics, the terminologies actually engage and play out, and how they interrelate and connect up with each other. And it's a fascinating a fascinating understanding once you begin to grab into it and comprehend what Paul is trying to say and the comparisons that he uses with the Old Testament to bring you through this veil into the New Testament, if I can use that terminology also, because it does provide a very systematic way or items of doctrine and life that you don't normally get or often get throughout the rest of the books. Now, keep in mind that the New Testament is written primarily in four categories. There are the Gospels. All of you know about them. Mark, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You thought I forgot, huh? But then there's the book of Acts. I remember that one, Acts. Then the epistles. I'm not going to read all of them. And, of course, the Apocalypse, the book of Revelation. And those are the four categories. The book of Romans is primarily an epistle, oftentimes also called a letter. However, the book of Romans goes beyond being a letter. It does go beyond being a letter. It is an epistle in the truest sense, I would say, by comparison to, for instance, the letter of Philemon. The book of Philemon in your New Testament, that would have been more of a letter because it actually was a personal letter that Paul wrote appealing to an individual who owned Philemon, who was a slave, and who apparently the Philemon stole something from him, the owner, and Paul was writing to the owner to ask him to forgive Philemon of what he did because here it turned out Philemon became converted. He repented and accepted Jesus Christ as a personal Savior. And so Paul, on his behalf, is appealing to this fellow to forgive Philemon because he's been such a good help to him, Paul, and so on. That was kind of a more personal letter. The book of Romans goes to a congregation in Rome, of which was one of the congregations that Paul did not have anything to do with beginning or starting. Paul did not seed the book of Romans. And most all scholars will also say, nor did the Apostle Peter. If anybody was in Rome, it was Paul who went to Rome. Peter, most likely, never did make it to Rome. So, you know, that's news to the Catholics, but unfortunately, that is the truth of the matter. That in, the fact is that there is no record of Peter really going to Rome. As a matter of fact, when you read Peter's epistles, if you read them very closely, you'll find out that he was over in Iraq. He was over by Iran, over by the area of Babylon, which is where that is. So he wasn't anywhere near Italy or Rome from that standpoint. But that's another story. I digress. But the book of Romans is quite a book because it does go beyond personal issues and personal letter type subjects. Now, that doesn't mean, nor does it dismiss or discard the fact that there aren't subjects in the book of Romans that are indeed built around information that apparently the Apostle Paul was privy to pertaining to that congregation. Let me show you some examples. Turn with me over here to Romans chapter 13 real quickly. Romans chapter 13. I'm not going to go through the whole chapter real quickly, but I want to just give you the genre, the gist of the writing here. Chapter 13. It talks basically about politics and government and so forth. He says here, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, meaning that of Rome. In this case, he's speaking of Rome. You Christians, pay your taxes. Abide by the authorities that rule the area that you live in. Be a good citizen. Be an upright citizen. And this was Rome, of all things. I mean, Rome was, you know, really a very corrupt thing, but yet Paul is appealing to the Romans there living in Rome, they're in the shadow of the Colosseum, where they had all those bloodbaths and all those bloody things going on, and where literally Christians were even basically sacrificed in some cases to lions and tigers and different types of things that they were used as fodder for entertainment. Yet, nevertheless, the Apostle Paul is appealing to the Christians that in that congregation, just like you folks. I mean, if it were us here and we were in Rome, we would get this letter and we would read it And Paul, one of his appeals to that particular congregation, because apparently there maybe perhaps was some problems, people a little bit rebellious, a little bit fanatical, a little bit on the outer edge about, you know, I don't like these Roman emperors, and getting a little bit fanatical about, and maybe even radical about politics. And they were bringing perhaps some of that into the congregation. Because Paul gets, here he says in verse 2, whosoever therefore resists the power, resists the ordinances of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror of good works. Oh yeah, tell me. What do you mean, ruler? We're talking about Rome here. And yet Paul, he's saying, chill. Obey the laws. Obey the emperor. Amazing. You know, we have a discussion, Wayne Hendricks and I have a discussion going on the internet on the web chat section of our website called Politics and the Bible. Getting a lot of feedback on that too, by the way. But if you haven't seen it, you should go ahead and become a little familiar with the discussion, because we kind of are going along and pulled and extrapolated this right out of the Bible to kind of illustrate the controversy of talking about politics and the Bible, politics and religion, you know, because guess what? They are intertwined. You can't get away from not talking about politics and the Bible, because that's what the Bible is about in many cases. It's about politics. God even says, does he not, that he's the one who raises up empires. He's the one that takes men out of positions and puts men in positions. So what does that have to do with the President of the United States? What does that have to do with the Prime Minister of England? Or the current Prime Minister of France? Or Canada? Or Australia? Should I go on? God chooses the leaders of the world to fit his design for his purposes. And if you don't know what God's purposes is, read your Bible. That may give you some insight on why certain individuals are leading certain countries at certain times. Thank God we had President Roosevelt during World War II. Thank God we had generals like Eisenhower and Patton in place during World War II. Thank God we had allies like Canada and the underground in France and others who helped push back those forces of tyranny and those forces of whatever you would call the Japanese at that time under Hirohito. Thank God we had God's hand in raising up those men and women to lead the Allies in the United States of America and Great Britain into the winning role that they did. Otherwise, you know it as well as I do, we'd all be speaking German or Japanese. And that's a fact. World War II would have went down as a total disaster, and we'd all have a whole different set of geopolitical conditions we're facing with today. That was not in the plans, and consequently did not come to fruition. Nevertheless, there must have been some difficulty over there in Rome in this congregation with the politics of the day, because he says here in verse 4, and he continues to emphasize, for he is the minister of God to you for good. He's talking about the emperor of Rome here. I mean, these guys were in Italy. This is where this letter was being written. And Paul's appealing to those Christians to really get in line with the Roman government and abide by the rules, not compromise your faith, of course. I'm not talking about that. All I'm saying is to be good citizens is what Paul is appealing to. Now, obviously, where conflict occurred with the state versus the Bible, God be praised, there were individuals who had the courage to stand in the gap and, regardless of the consequences, take what the government would dish out in lieu of the violation that they would end up being in due to the requirement the government was requiring them to break that would violate God's law. That is a different case. That's a different case. But what Paul is saying here, in general, if there's no requirement for you to compromise your faith, then don't worry about it. Be a good citizen. Pay your taxes. Submit to the government. And obey the laws of the land. And do what you can to be the model citizen of which you should be. And that's essentially where he's going with some of this that he's talking about. Romans 14, look at this. There must have been some issues going on with individuals in the congregation thinking that they were better than others. And he goes on talking about how we shouldn't judge each other. Verse 13, let us not therefore judge one another anymore. And he goes on talking about these two major issues with regard to fasting and days of choice, of particular choices that they chose to do that on. It isn't about the Sabbath. It's not about clean and unclean meats. It's about fasting. It's about what you choose, which day, Wednesday or Thursday or Monday or Sunday. But we'll get into that as we get into these particular chapters. Chapter 16, and over here in verse 17, and apparently there must have been a little bit of this going on as well. He says, I beseech you, brethren, mark them, meaning to take note of them, be vigilant with them or toward them. In other words, take notice, be attentive to those, not marking them in the sense of reading their names from the lectern and then publicly embarrassing them in front of everybody. No, no, no. That's not what we're talking about here. What the Greek word means simply is to be vigilant and attentive to those which cause division and offenses contrary to the doctrine which you have learned, and avoid them. Avoid them. The Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians over there and handling a situation there, you know that story in chapter 5 where the guy was basically shacking up either with his stepmother or biological mother, and Paul was saying, hey, throw the guy out of the church. You know, he's creating division because now it wasn't so much, I mean, if it was a secret thing and he was really ashamed of what he was doing, that would be one thing. But this guy was puffed up, Paul said. Remember, he uses the word puffed up. He had an attitude. He was braggadocious. I got a relationship with my mom. What? You know, but I mean, that's what was going on. And he was creating division. And people were also, being that he was getting away with it, beginning to think, well, maybe they ought to be able to do some things too. And it was like leaven. And as a matter of fact, it was even written during the days of unleavened bread. We've read chapter 5, 1 Corinthians there oftentimes with regard to some of the statements there in the scriptures you're well aware of that I won't go to for the sake of time. But many of you, I think, and it's certainly no surprise that that narrative was written during the days of unleavened bread. And so consequently, it became very pertinent for Paul at that time to use terminology like you're puffed up, you know, you're bragging on your situation, like you're getting away with something. That's not good, and it's causing division. So here, basically in these three chapters, and I could probably point out a few other chapters as well, that Paul is addressing some personal issues in that congregation at Rome, of which he must have been privy to due to intel that he was getting from the folks via letters or maybe in traveling with individuals who had visited the congregation that came back to him and shared with him certain things that were going on over there. But the point of it is, Paul was well aware of some of the things that were going on there, although he was not the one who started that particular group, like over in Corinth. He started in Ephesians. He started those particular congregations. But it does also, the book, goes through other subjects that go beyond the congregation, in Rome. As a matter of fact, some of the subjects, for instance, let me take your attention over here to Romans 6. And Romans 6 is a very obvious and interesting chapter with regard to the subject matter, illustrating how some of these subjects in the book of Romans go beyond the local issues that were being contended with by the congregation. Here, chapter 6, Paul, after he comes out of chapter 5, and you get the flow, you'll get the flow of this as we go through some of these chapters, but I'm just kind of giving you a little bit of an overview here. You read chapter 5, and you'll see how that all swings into chapter 6, because you have to remember also, the book of Romans is a letter. Remember, the translators divided it up into chapters and verses. So really, this is a free-flowing letter. In the original manuscript, it wouldn't be broken out into chapters and verses. It would just be a letter, like you wrote a letter to somebody. And so in this case, chapter 5 is in context with chapter 6. That's all I'm saying. So it's really not a break of different subjects, or it's not a patchwork of topics that are all just kind of, you know, patched together. No. This is a letter. So if you would read chapter 5 and chapter 6 together, you would see how it all flows together, so that Paul then, as he finishes up the segment of chapter 5, he gets into a break. The translators chose to break the thought processing or the writing at this point and start a new chapter. And he says basically, what shall we say then? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? Now, where's he coming from with those questions? Well, he's coming from what he said in chapter 5. I'm not going to go back there and read it. I'm just telling you that's the bridge comment. So he's kind of challenging himself. You know, after I told you everything in chapter 5, so what are we supposed to say? What are we supposed to say? And he asks this question. Shall we continue in sin so that grace may abound? And obviously, when you know some of the issues that were going on and heresies that were surrounding the early New Testament church, in that there were some Gnostics, who were going around stating that if you sin more, you'll get more of God's grace. If you want more of God's grace, if you want His attention, then sin more. Get drunk more often. Commit fornication more frequently. If you're married, hey, have a dozen partners. Commit adultery as often as you can. Because in so doing, you'll get more of God's grace. And he's pulling his hair out, saying, no, what shall we say? And you can read some of this logic as he builds up to it from chapter 5. He says, God forbid, in verse 2, how shall we that are dead to sin, figure of speech, live any longer therein? And then he proceeds to describe the baptismal rite, the symbol of baptism and what it means. And he uses that as a demarcation of this initiation into a new way of life that should give us a whole different look on sin. And he proceeds basically chapter 6 talking about sin. And if there was anybody who ever thought that the grace of God replaces the requirement or sense of obligation we have as Christians to obey the law, well, I don't know how you would still hold that notion after reading chapter 6. Because chapter 6 is very crystal clear and plain speech about the fact that no. Regardless of the grace you're in, the fact is you are obligated to obey certain good works. And if you don't, he concludes over here in verse 23, and many of you are well aware of this, the wages of sin is death. And keep in mind, he's talking to Christians. He's talking to Christians. What does that mean? That means you, as a Christian, if you continue in a lifestyle that is contrary to the values and standards of Jesus Christ, and of which you should now be putting upon yourself to represent after you went through the baptismal rite, then you too will die. Because the once saved, always saved mythical doctrine is just that. It's mythical. It doesn't exist. It's not in your Bible. It is not once saved, always saved. Christ did not do it all for us. And this book goes through some of those logistics, illustrating some of the relationships of the things that we're going to get into here as we go through some of the subjects that each chapter illustrates and discloses and reveals. Now, some also thought, and I'll show you just a little bit of a kind of a nuance here, because there's a lot of things embedded in these scriptures that we oftentimes don't take note of with regard to the real lives of these guys, and in this particular case, the Apostle Paul. For instance, some scholars will say that the Apostle Paul basically wrote the book of Romans for this reason, and that is that he wanted to send the letter out before he actually arrived on the scene in Rome so that he could kind of, for the sake of a term, plow the ground, so to speak, and orient the people in Rome of the very gospel that he's been preaching for about 20 years, because, by the way, this book was written, most will say, in about 57 A.D., which is about almost, 25, 30 years after Christ ascended back to the Father. So this is a few decades after Jesus had already ascended back to the Father. And in this case, the Apostle Paul was definitely planning a trip. Get this, planning a trip to Spain. Over here in Romans 15, and in verse 21, we'll break into the context real quickly here. He says, "But as it was written," or as it is written, "to whom he was not spoken of, they shall see, and they that have not heard shall understand. For which cause also I have been much hindered from coming to you." So he wanted to come to them sooner, and he's basically saying, but he's been hindered. "But now, having no more place in these parts, and having a great desire these many years to come unto you," that is to Rome, to you folks in Rome, "whensoever I take my journey into Spain, I will come to you, for I trust to see you in my journey and to be brought on my way thitherward by you, if first I be somewhat filled with your company." So what he's saying is basically, he's going to visit you, I'm going to visit you in Rome there on my way to Spain, And so some scholars will say he wrote this prior to that trip to send on ahead to Rome, to the congregation, so they would be briefed and oriented on what he's been speaking and preaching. And he was fully intending, as some of these scholars will say, to use Rome as a base of operation to launch evangelistic campaigns into Spain. And some will even say, even further, he went on into England. But that's another story, and certainly not something that I want to get into today. But the second point of it is also that some scholars will say, well, that may be true. However, there's another concern that Paul may have had that drove him to write such a comprehensive treatise. And that's why there's a lot of thought over trying to investigate what motivated him to write this comprehensive document. Because it is quite detailed on the definition of how salvation works, how it should be understood by the Christian in his relationship to God, and how God is actually engaged in interacting with us as human beings to afford the result of salvation, of redemption, of being able to be resurrected and enter into the dimension of immortals, of being an immortal. Because that's an important bit of instruction to understand, I would say, because if you don't understand it, if you get the owner's manual for something that valuable, I would strongly suggest you read the manual so that you would understand how this works. Here's the manual. And Romans, the book, the whole book, all chapters, all 16 of them, right? Yeah, 16 of them, are geared toward helping us to understand what's expected and how, therefore, it works. So it's important to take the time, certainly to go through the book of Romans and be able to extrapolate out some of the value of it, because in so doing, writing this, there was something behind Paul's motivation. Now, as I say, the second reason that many scholars will say is because he was thinking, maybe paranoid, I don't know, but just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not chasing you. The fact of it is that he thought perhaps he wouldn't live very long, and he better lay some record down for what he was preaching and what was understood to be truly information from God that would be helpful to the Christian in his development with his relationship with God. And they cite this over here in chapter 15 also, and in verse 30, where Paul states this, "Now I beseech you, brethren, for the Lord Jesus Christ's sake and for the love of the Spirit, that you strive together with me in your prayers to God for me. See, he's asking them to pray for him. And here's why. Verse 31, that I may be delivered from them that do not believe in Judea. In other words, he knew the Jews were after him. Now, he knew that already and was well aware of it. And you can read Acts chapter 19 and 20 because that overlays in some of this. The book of Acts is basically the chronicle, the itinerary of Paul's life and his ministry in many respects. And, of course, the Apostle Peter to a lesser degree, but nevertheless, and some of the other apostles, by the way. But the point of it is that a lot of what you read in the ancillary epistles, such as Romans and Colossians and Ephesians and these other epistles, actually all plug in to the book of Acts. They all plug into the book of Acts. So that in these travels, you can kind of gauge where and what some of the things were that was framing the time that generated the writings of Colossians, that generated the writings of Ephesians or the Philippian church and so on, to give you a better concept of the context of why certain things were written. And in the book of Acts 19 and, of course, chapter 20, you will see that the Christians were viewed as threats. In the one case, Alexander the coppersmith, remember that guy? Remember Paul said in one of the epistles, Alexander the coppersmith has done me great harm? Well, Alexander the coppersmith was a idol maker. And he would make idols for Diana. He had a thriving business. And you had a group of guys coming in and out through Ephesus, through Colossae and other areas who were basically espousing the fact Diana was nothing more than that. A building, an idea, a myth. She was not a god. So don't buy the statues. And this guy was pulling his hair out because they were ruining his business. It was that simple. They were ruining his business. And you can read about that in Acts 19 and chapter 20 about what was going on here. And that was just one thing. That was just one thing. There were other situations that the Apostle Paul found himself in. Remember, he had to get lowered out of a basket from a window. One time he was stoned to death and they thought he was dead. He could have been dead. But later on they dragged him out and he turned out to be alive and came back to life. But the point of it is that he was in and out of hot water all the time because what he was doing was being accused of turning the world upside down. He was accused, along with others, of turning the world upside down through the gospel of Jesus Christ. This was new stuff, very new, and yet it was old. Yet it was not, or shouldn't have been, especially to the Jews, a surprise. Why do I say that? The Old Testament. The Old Testament prophets and the writings constantly portrayed the news of the coming Messiah. There was no surprise. The articles and documents of where he was going to be born in Bethlehem was written in the prophets. The fact that he would come out of Egypt, which he did, because remember, he was told, Joseph, his stepfather, his surrogate father, who ended up marrying his real mother, Mary, because Herod was going to kill all the babies, remember, 2 years and younger, where did they go? They went to Egypt to hide for 2 years until Herod died, right? And then guess what? After he died, here comes the Lord out of Egypt. That's in the prophecies. Like I've often said, Nostradamus has nothing over the Bible, man. Has nothing over the Bible. And yet people do not give credit where credit is due with regards to some of these things. At any rate, the Old Testament is a very, very important part of the Bible and does give that validity, validation, credibility, the stamp of approval to all of the New Testament writings. The book of Romans. The book of Romans is an important transitional book. All 16 chapters. A very important transitional book abridging the meanings, the spiritual depth that is not necessarily recognized in the Old Testament due to the physical relationships of so much that was material in its orientation to teach mankind of the connection to God. But in the New Testament, book of Romans especially, and Hebrews, brings you through that transition and begins to translate what was established in the Old Testament, but with a spiritual in-depth understanding of what all that Old Testament stuff really was all about. And that's where people miss, they really miss the value of the Old Testament in that regard. Now, as I mentioned, the book, they believe, was written in around 57 A.D. And this is an interesting point. This is another one of those little nuances that you don't necessarily pick up, but is important from this standpoint, that it helps when understanding these little nuances that I'm about to share with you here, another one. It helps you, I think, to grasp the fact that these people were real people. They had real lives. They wrestled and struggled with the same things that you and I wrestle and struggle with. We're in more modern times. Yeah, we drive around in cars, you know, that go 100 miles an hour. As a matter of fact, I was looking on the internet this week regarding some cars that are coming out of this new car show up there in Detroit, these types of cars that they're planning on building. They've got Cadillacs bringing forth a car with a 600 horsepower that easily does 200 miles an hour, a CTS, a four-door sedan. Where in the world are you going to drive that car, 600 horsepower at 200 miles an hour? Somebody's going to kill themselves with that thing. But at any rate, all I'm saying is things are different than what they were back then, but that doesn't dismiss the fact, nor does it devalue the fact, that these were real people too. They had struggles and similar issues with health and job and concern of family and kids and delinquency and all the things that go along with some of the same things that we deal with here. And this nuance kind of illustrates that. Here in Romans chapter 16, let me bring your attention back. And this is why, as I say, going back to what I'm reading this for, many scholars believe is the reason why they think the book was written in around 57 A.D. And that is here, the Apostle Paul, of all things, addresses a guy that you're familiar with. You've heard his name over and over. And his name is Gaius. And over in verse 23, it states this, Gaius, mine host, and of the whole church, salutes you, Erastus, and the chamberlain of the city salutes you, and Quartus, a brother. Now, where is Gaius at? Well, if you go over here and go to 1 Corinthians chapter 1, 1 Corinthians chapter 1, and in verse 14, you will see Paul addressing some particulars with regards to issues being contended with there in Corinth, but states this in the course of that narrative. He says this in verse 13. Is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Or were you baptized in the name of Paul? He's correcting the Corinthians. I thank God I baptized none of you but Crispus and Gaius. And Gaius was also so very well known in the Corinthian congregation that apparently even the Apostle John knew him, because if you go back to 3 John, the epistle of 3 John, you'll see that John is writing to Gaius. So Gaius knew John, and Gaius knew Paul. These are real people. And they match this up, of course, with the fact that if Paul was with Gaius at this time, because he says Gaius was his host in verse 23 here in Romans chapter 16, verse 23, then apparently Paul was in Corinth, and he was there in the, I think it was the spring of 57 A.D. that would have given him the time to sit down and write this very exhaustive exposition called the Book of Romans. So with that being said, it just goes to explain and show that these were real people, and that Paul gave, and many scholars will claim that the reason why Paul opens chapter 16 with this opening in verse 1 and 2 is because Phoebe, the woman, Phoebe, was given the document, the manuscript of Romans, and told to take it. And Phoebe delivered it. And here in 16 verse 1, he says, I commend unto you Phoebe, our sister, which is a servant of the church, which is at Centria, that you receive her in the Lord as become saints, and that you assist her in whatsoever business she has need of, for she has been a securer of many and of myself also. In other words, Phoebe was a very well-known saint among the community of Christians, and she was to be given respect and to be taken care of in the business that she was going to be giving and doing over there in Rome. And so he's kind of laying down the groundwork there and giving her a little bit of an introduction. So what am I saying here is that Romans is a very important book. It's comprehensive. It goes beyond. It does indeed go beyond some of the little personal things that were site-specific to Rome and that congregation. However, as we see, we can extrapolate some of those personal issues that those folks were dealing with some short of 2,000 years ago and understand that they're very current to us today, are they not? Because there's still division in the church. There's still a lot of riffraff going on between people trying to balance politics and the Bible. There's some people that are more out there, you know, more activist types. There's others that are more pacifist types. There are some that won't vote in the Church of God, and there's some that will vote in the Church of God. There are some that don't want to be involved in anything that pertains to any kind of civil recognition of the government and or the country, even to the point that there are some Christian denominations today that will not even observe Thanksgiving. And that's the way it is. And so all I'm saying is we still have these same controversies, these same issues that we bounce back and forth with that they did as well. And like I said, the time then is not that much different than the time now. But also here, before we close out today, because again, this is just a small introduction, I wanted to turn here to Romans 8 for a moment and bring your attention to this. This chapter, if you're not familiar with this chapter in the book of Romans, you should get familiar with it. I would strongly suggest you get a few translations of the Bible and read the different ways that it is written in the Bible, and get yourself a concordance with a good King James Bible and look up some of the words that are key benchmark words throughout the course of this chapter within the book of Romans. Because this chapter is a Bible within the Bible. This chapter is a Bible within the Bible. One of my favorite chapters in the whole book of the Bible, period, because it is so jam-packed full of so much meat and potatoes of what the program of salvation is all about and what it pertains to. And a lot of people say, well, you know, Bill, and would argue with me that you're making too much of the book of Romans because, you know, you're saying it's so comprehensive, but there's no mention of the holy days in the book of Romans. There's not even a mention of the return of Jesus Christ in the book of Romans. But you have to understand, that wasn't the topic. That wasn't the subject. That wasn't really the segmented issue of attention that the Apostle Paul wanted to zero in on like a laser beam to express and expose, disclose, and articulate. He was on a much different mission, a much different purpose. He had a much different objective in mind in attempting to achieve certain information to the minds of the Christians when he wrote the treatise of the whole book of Romans. However, in the book, or in the chapter, I should say, of 8 of the book of Romans, he hits on so much, and again, I'm not going to get into a lot of detail here. We will be backing up into it as we begin to go through the book of Romans throughout the year. But the point that I wanted to make is that he goes down here to a real heart and core of the whole salvation issue and states this here down in verse 16. The Spirit itself, and that's a capital S with Spirit, talking about God's Spirit, bears witness with our spirit. And there is a spirit in man. There is a spiritual element that works in with our physical brain that gives you and I the understanding and idea of of being able to appreciate abstracts. There is a spiritual component in the brain or brain matter of man, without a doubt. There is, and oftentimes has been miscalculated and misinterpreted to be a soul or some kind of a spirit that can live outside of the embodiment of the human brain, which is a fallacy and a myth and is not taught at all in the Bible. Your brain goes down, so does the spirit of man. Without the spirit of man, or without the brain, the spirit of man is non-functional, is non-functional. The Spirit of God combines with the Spirit of man. That's what the apostle is saying here when he says, your consciousness, you could say it that way too, your consciousness bears witness with the consciousness of God. That comes through reading, understanding, studying the Word of God. That's how the consciousness of God comes into your brain, and that Spirit supernaturally should give insight to your studies to help you integrate that information with your consciousness, your physical human consciousness, to allow and afford you to be able to comprehend the means by which you, as a human being, personality, whoever you are, persona, whoever you are, to reflect Christ in your life. That can't be legislated. That can't be dictated to you. Only you know yourself, and only you know how you are. And you, in your own special little way, in your unique way, is important for you to recognize then how to integrate that. And that only comes through your own personal Bible study. As I've often said, I could get up here, flap my jaw all day long. And you know what? It can only do a limited good for you. It really can. Where the real growth, where the real organic metabolism, spiritual metabolism comes from, is your own studying, your own interaction with God, and the actual exercising of godly attributes in your life that you yourself witness by the reaction of others who come in contact with you as you learn to apply these in your life. Now, if you don't apply them in your life, you'll never get those reactions and therefore miss the evidence and consequently won't have the encouragement to pursue the motivation that's necessary to continue the growth process that can come through the organic recognition of the Spirit of God in you. Don't ask me to repeat that. But you know what I'm saying. It is important. It is important to understand the integration of these two forces, yours and God's, which marries you through the process of baptism and that recognition of your commitment to God to allow Him to have His way with you. Because that's where it all begins. And how much you allow Him to have His way with you will determine the amount of growth and encouragement, motivation, and all those things that come with your continued relationship and development with God. So here is a this verse 16 is loaded. It's just loaded with stuff. And in 17 he continues on. He says, "And if children," and he states children of God in verse 16. So then he says, "If children," meaning referencing, building off, taking off of verse 16. He says, "So if you're children, then heirs. You're heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ. If so be that we suffer with Him, that we may be also glorified together." Why does he say suffer? He says suffer. You should look that word up to get the real meaning of it. Because it is hard living in the flesh to do the spiritual things. Because you're in constant conflict with yourself. You want to lose your temper. You want to strangle this guy. You want to whack that kid so hard that you'll set him right through the glass. And you struggle. You want to do something so bad that you can't even dare think or say it to such and such for this and that. Or you don't have the patience, you just want to get. And so that's really what you want, but you know you shouldn't. We all struggle with these things. I want to eat more ice cream, but I know I can't because I'm already 300 pounds. You know, I want to watch more TV, but I don't have the time. But I'm going to do it anyway. And you do, until finally you catch yourself a week later finding out that 80% of your time is being spent watching TV. And you say, oh, I shouldn't have done that. We battle with these things. I don't want to get up. I want to sleep late. Oh, I'm late for work again. All these things. Brethren, we struggle with them because the flesh is constantly in conflict with the spiritual, with the spiritual values. The spiritual value is there to motivate you to become bigger and better than what you are, to make you something that you can only be with God. And so it's important that we listen to the spiritual, I don't want to say voices because that kind of sounds insane, but you know what I mean. The intuition, let me say that. The little voice in you, I'll use that word, that feeling, that notion that says, you know what, I should be doing this. I should call that person. I can't tell you how many times I say to myself, I should call that person. And I'll offer you this little thing. And I didn't. And they died. In ministry, those opportunities come your way. And then you got to live with it. You see, brethren, we're all struggling. We're all struggling in these things. This is what he's saying. Suffer. You suffer. Oh, yeah, we do. That we may be also glorified. In other words, you got to make those things happen in your life if you want to grow. For I reckon that the suffering of these present times, or this present time, are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. For the earnest expectation of the creation waits for the manifestation of the sons of God. And right here, oftentimes I shake my head, scratch my hair, wondering why in the world do scholars say he's not talking about the resurrection, when right here he's talking about the resurrection. He's talking about the birthing of the sons of God. He's talking about the redemption of your body and essentially changing, and how the whole world is groaning in pain, waiting for the day of redemption and the manifestation of the sons of God. That's the resurrection. But oftentimes, people don't understand that terminology. Why? Because they think when you die, you're wafting off to heaven. That you have an immortal soul in your body. And that's how it happens. And it's foreign to them to understand this kind of terminology. But yet, Paul talks and does indeed touch on the resurrection. So, all these things, brethren, we're going to kind of get into. Romans 8, like I said, is quite a chapter. It's a Bible within itself. So, over the next year, 2015, I'm going to try to salt and pepper all these chapters, 16 of them, into a few presentations so that hopefully we can have a better understanding and a better concept of how this program we're all involved with, that we've committed to, that we've been baptized into, called salvation, works in our lives.